We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 17, Potter and the Pig. For joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I are going to share our thoughts about J.K. Rowling's latest novel, The Christmas Pig. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Emily, it's just you and me today.
Yep, just us.
Welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
What are your hopes for the new year?
Great question. I have several exciting writing and podcasting projects that I launched last year that I'm just excited to kind of keep afloat and keep going and to see them through. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, so I'm kind of in a similar boat. You know, with the new year, you think of starting something new, but I think I'm actually following through, like you were saying, with some projects and so on, and, you know, getting some good Potterversity episodes and some other exciting things on our Potterversity horizon coming nearer and nearer. And, I'm trying to get a little balance in my world, you know, trying to think about the sort of spiritual life of the full person and trying to inhabit that as I get to my 50th year here. So
yeah,
I turned 50 this year, 2022.
And so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. So it makes you think, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I found 40 to be a similar experience. I'm sure 50 is even more intense.
I was pregnant at 40, so it was sort of different.
Yeah, 40.
Yeah, I was like, it's got to be now, or that's it.
yes. So, right. Well, thank you for blazing that trail ahead of me. I'm sure I will benefit from the wisdom that you share about that experience.
I hope I get some wisdom. We'll see. I'm ready. I'm trying to prime myself. I'm open, universe. Bring me wisdom. Well, Emily, I received The Christmas Pig from my daughter for Christmas this year as a Christmas present. Yes. Yeah. And I just tore through it when I was visiting my folks down in South Carolina over the holiday. I found it to be a really good read, and it reminded me a lot of the experience that I had reading the Harry Potter books, you know, where you just feel like the writing carries you along.
Oh, yes.
And you're just wrapped up in the story. And, you know, just the gifts of Rowling as an author, I think, are definitely on display in this particular book. And so I thought also there's a lot of richness there that I think we could talk about. And so I'm so glad that you're willing to join me for this Christmas Pig episode.
Oh, anytime. Yeah, funnily enough, this past semester, I did a lot of research on Christmas in Harry Potter and the function of Christmas in Harry Potter and the theological meanings that it brings to the story. And so I had to buy The Christmas Pig because I was giving a presentation at Chestnut Hill about some of my research. And so I had to buy The Christmas Pig the day it came out. and try to read at least some of it before the presentation, because part of my plan was to comment on, you know, whether this was consistent with the way Christmas is treated in Harry Potter. And so, so I read it in October. I think I finished it by November. So it was a little less fresh in my mind than maybe for you, but I did try to review it a little bit before our conversation today. So, but I remember feeling exactly that way when I was reading it. Just it's so easy for me to read her writing, you know, and it just kind of flows over my eyes, you know, and just into my brain. And
yeah,
and I just can, you know, I can really read very quickly, which sometimes, you know, is almost an inducement to reread. And that's interesting. It's interesting because in my work on Christmas, in Harry Potter, I found that Christmas itself, all the Christmas episodes really reward rereading because there's so many flashes of insight into what's bound to happen in the plot.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, so it's one of those things in Harry Potter that really rewards rereading. And I think that's true also of The Christmas Pig.
Yeah. And I, you know, I was sort of thinking too that the, you know, you talked about the flow of the reading, and like, I always thought of the Potter books as brain candy. And that's how this story felt. And then as I was preparing for this episode, I was like, wow, this is really deep, which is also the same experience I had with the Harry Potter novels.
Right.
I was like, oh, wait a minute.
Right. I want to know what's happening. I want to know what's happening. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot here. Yes. Now
feeling all the feels.
Yes. Oh, well, and the feels too.
Oh, yeah. The feels.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I did. I think I texted you while I was reading it, and I was like, Christmas Pig, making me cry.
Yep.
Making me cry.
It was, you know, especially the way it begins. And maybe should we give a spoiler alert to
our listeners? Yes. So I was just about to head there. Listeners, if you have not read The Christmas Pig, you can take a couple hours to do that. It is a good read, and you will fly through it. You can take a couple hours and rejoin us, or if you don't mind spoilers, you can anticipate the read. You can have it be almost like a second read as you're reading it for the first time, which is, there's something fun about that too. I have a friend who, she doesn't mind spoilers. She actually kind of likes spoilers. So
I can see that. I can see that. I always tell people, you know, it's, even if it's spoiled, it's still good. To read the first time. It's still good.
And I mean, we're just going to talk about the books in their fullness, and we don't want to have to tiptoe around some of the most important bits, either read it and come back or stay with us and, you know, be inspired, so that you can anticipate, all of the interesting things that I think you will find are in this book.
Yeah. I was going to say that as it begins, it's really a bit dark, you know, in terms of what happens with Jack and his parents' divorce, and kind of it's kind of a shocking, you know, sort of turn of events for him. Mm-hmm. And
it's not a double murder. Harry Potter begins with a double murder.
Correct. Yeah. But it is not so grim as that.
But it is divorce, you know.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's almost more poignant in the real life, you know, sort of quality of it, you know, how often we know that happens and how many times kids and sadly, especially even only children, you know, get mixed up in that and have to cope with those changes. And you know, the whole first part of the book is him coping with the many changes and the constancy of his friend Der Pig throughout all that.
Yeah. And so you've got the boy, and then you've got Der Pig, and Der Pig is sometimes called DP.
Yes.
Yeah. And he is the beloved, like he's a lovey, as they used to say. Yeah.
A little plush friend.
Like a little beanbag friend.
Yeah.
Little beanie boo pig who has been well loved, so that he just has these little button eyes instead of the regular eyes he used to have. And his ears are kind of cockeyed, and he's a funny gray color, and he's got all kinds of weird smells. Right. Right. And
it's totally boy.
As truly a well-loved object.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is visible from the wear and tear on him, you know?
Right.
And so therefore irreplaceable in some ways.
Yeah.
And yet something really horrible happens to Der Pig as we have this merged household.
Right.
Because of divorce and remarriage. And this girl at school, Holly, who had seemed pretty friendly, she's having her own difficulties coping with the divorce and some parental pressure about gymnastics. And she turns out to be like a very mean stepsister type figure. Yeah. She's 11 or 12, something
like that.
And yeah, I can 13, tell maybe. You from personal experience, this is a hard age. There's lots of stuff going on there. And she's not very nice. And as they are arguing, he calls her a loser because she's lost in this gymnastics competition. And gymnastics is where all the pressure is coming from. Calls her a loser and puts like the L up on his forehead.
Mm.
And this is from a kid who is very sweet normally.
Yes.
And she throws Derpig out the window on a speeding motorway.
Right.
Horror.
Right.
Horror. Oh. I mean, that was gut-wrenching right there.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, I should also say I have kind of a little bit of a bad reaction to lost items. Like, I myself personally do not like losing things. When I have lost something, I will spend far more time than that thing is worth looking for it.
Emily, this book is for you.
I know. You know, I have a really good relationship with St. Anthony. Because he is the patron of lost items.
Oh.
Although I do call him St. Anthony. My Italian friends call him Tony. I do not call him Tony. I call him St. Anthony. You know, I feel like extra respect is part of our relationship because he really always finds things for me. And so this was a hard book for me because, you know, that idea of that lost item and things not being complete until that lost item is back where it belongs. You know, that was particularly tough. And
right.
I wondered if the author doesn't feel the same way, you know, and if this imagination came out of the mind of someone who also feels like that. Not to verge into crit fic here, but I had those thoughts. I thought, I could have written this.
Well, because what happens is, okay, Holly in remorse is sort of forced to buy Jack a replacement pig.
Right.
Who is a shiny new pink pig with the little, you know, the plastic eyes, the way they're supposed to be and smells new and all that, and presents him with this replacement. That's with a capital R in the world of lost things. So he's
right. And this is all happening on Christmas Eve.
Right.
All happening on Christmas Eve.
And this is bad. This is not, Holly's gift is not well received. Jack goes into a flaming temper tantrum, and he's like a sweet kid. The grandpa's right. Like, this isn't like you. But because he had, you know, Derpig was the one thing that stayed the same, and he could always talk to Derpig, and it was he had put so much of, you know, his stability into that relationship with that object, that to not have it and to have Holly be the instrument of its loss, it's just too much for him. And he just, you know, he snaps.
It was almost too much for me. I'm not going to lie.
It was rough. I was like, how are we going to get Derpig back? And I don't know about this Christmas pig here, but what's the solution? And I was quite worried that this was going to have Jack going out to the motorway in his pajamas.
Oh, he wanted to.
He
wanted
was going to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But he has another adventure instead.
Mm-hmm. Right. He goes to basically the underworld for objects.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like I was thinking of Lily Panucci with Harry in the underworld and Aeneas.
Yeah.
In the underworld. This is an underworld journey, but for objects, their death is when they're lost. The objects in Jack's room come to life. And the Christmas pig particularly has masterminded this idea to go to this underworld, the land where lost things go, to try to find their pig again. And
right.
The only way that happens is the magic of Christmas.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
No and explanation so, needed.
Right. And that gives it a little time parameter too, which gives you that feeling of, oh my gosh, are they going to
get
out
done?
Of this?
Yeah.
Right, and so right. Jack is shrunk down to the size of an action figure and goes with Christmas Pig into this kind of adventure in being a lost toy, or not even just a lost toy, a lost thing.
Yes, a lost item. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And they go on this journey. In the end, we have a happy ending. And I'm sure we'll talk about that as we go through, analyzing it some. So it has this happy ending, and it gives you that same feeling, I think, as the Harry Potter books, but, you know, just in the one novel, as opposed to the 7-book series. So my first question, Emily, is what do you think are some of the similarities between The Christmas Pig and the Potter novels?
Well, you know, as we'd said, there was a similar feel to a lot of it. And I would say in terms of the audience, like Harry Potter, this is really an all ages book. But I think all ages here stretches even a bit younger than it did for Potter. There's something about the point of view. I think we're in third person limited omniscience from Jack's point of view, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It's more innocent. The voice of the narrator is more innocent, though not without those clever and satisfying turns of phrase that sort of indicate that your main character is really an old soul, you know. So I'm thinking about when he and the Christmas pig are going off to kind of find the land of the lost, and the Christmas pig is being very rude, or so Jack thinks. And he thinks to himself, well, he and Holly really deserve each other, because the Christmas pig says, I'll take you to the land of lost if when we're back with Der Pig, you give me to Holly because she was nice, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jack kind of thinks, well, these two deserve each other, you know, which is kind of more of an adult thing to think, you know, but it's still believable. So there's just something a little more innocent about the narrator that I think is a nice way of including even very young children. I think you could read this out loud to a 3 or 4 year old, you know, maybe glossing over a few of the scarier parts, but then they could follow along very well with the story.
Yeah. And Jack is himself a younger character. He's not 11. He's more like, what, 9, 6? Maybe 8.
Oh, yeah. I would even put him maybe at 6 even or younger. 7. Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. So I definitely do think it seems like its target is for this younger age group. And yet, like you said, it's absolutely readable. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And that's part of that is because Rowling does not talk down to children.
Right.
When she writes books like this, they are books that have profound truths that, you know, are just as good for me at 49 to think about as my 9-year-old kid.
Yeah.
I'm like, he needs to read this book.
Oh yeah. My 10-year-old read it right away. He enjoyed it. He flew through it and he really enjoyed it.
So I also was thinking, and I said this too about, the underworld journey. And I think that loss for a thing is like a kind of death, and death is obviously a huge theme in both the Harry Potter series. And I think death is a theme here. It's maybe not a literal death in the sense that what has died is maybe these two marriages, you know?
Yes. Yes.
And then Der Pig. And again, big spoiler here, Der Pig cannot come back. No. Right. No. And you know, we've got, this kind of malevolent force in Holly.
Yes.
And you know, Der Pig is literally obliterated when a tractor trailer blasts him on the motorway. There's some grisly, like you said, dark, tough stuff. And we don't know that about Der Pig until later on when that's revealed that, you know, there's no bringing Der Pig back. And once you realize that, then you know, as you're trying to think ahead of the story, you're trying to think, how's this going to turn out? And I think that also that feeling of, you know, how do you deal with a loss that cannot be reclaimed? Harry cannot get his parents back.
Right.
I think that's a common theme here between the two.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, I found a lot of particularly Christian notions at the heart of this story myself. I mean, obviously, that's my religion. So maybe I, you know, see that more than other people might. But I think that this theme of coping with and dealing with our own mortality And the specter of mortality that hangs over our human existence is really significant. And this story really says lost things really aren't lost. Even if they really are lost, they're never really lost, which, you know, if you think about it, is a notion that helps us cope with mortality, which is the ultimate loss. As you said, you know, if Dumbledore were in this book, he would say something like, "The lost things we lose are never really lost, except if they get eaten by the loser, then they really are." Something like that. And you're right. The loser is definitely cast as a devil figure, as a, almost like a Satan figure.
Yeah. And the loser figure. So he calls Holly loser in the car when he's talking to her. But then the loser ends up as like the Satan of this underworld.
He's the dark lord of the land of the lost. Yeah.
Yeah.
He really is. And he's you know, he is a bully, you know, and I think that's another similarity with Rowling's other works, is that she deals a lot with bullying in this story. And yet, you know, Holly is our sort of initial bully. And yet Holly is very much hinted at being a very sympathetic character for a bully, which I think is actually a really interesting element at this point in history myself. But the ultimate story bully is the loser, capital L loser, who is this lord of the land of the lost. And if you don't follow all his rules, you know, then you could be eaten by the loser. And yet he makes the rules, and so he'll change them and cheat and things like that. And, you know, which is,
he's arbitrary. He's a tyrant. And that kind of idea of tyranny and, you know, unjust power is also totally consistent.
Definitely. And it's interesting to see bullying cast in that, in those terms of evil, you know, in terms of, you know, we had that great conversation a few episodes ago about bullying. And so that was kind of an interesting new aspect that I hadn't thought of.
Also, the loser is interesting because the loser is literally made up of the scraps of broken things that he has destroyed and then he puts on himself.
Yeah, and he consumes them.
Yeah, he's machine-like, kind of animatronic, and very material.
Right.
Villain. And in that way, I thought he was really similar to Voldemort in that sense of, you know, he becomes immortal through destruction and pretty much a gross debasement of material existence and not realizing that there are other higher forms of existence than the material. And I thought that was a really close match between this book and Harry Potter.
Yeah, I thought so too. You know, as much as I said that I found a lot of Christian themes in it, I think you could take a lot of this on the level of consumerism and the effect that it has on our society and still have it be a very profound story.
It's the anti-modernism that we see in Harry Potter, the anti-modernist, anti-materialist and rationalist that she's also playing with here.
Right. Kind of a Tolkien strain, very much man versus the machine age, you know,
And
certainly,
you know,
going on here.
We see also that, you know, what defeats the loser and this materialism that's constructed of waste and destruction is love, and the very real power and transformative power of love itself. So I thought that also, I mean, that's just straight out of Harry Potter.
Yes. Which is straight out of like, you know,
everything,
a lot of religious traditions, you know?
Yes.
No, there is a solution to the story problem. Right. And the solution is, you know, incarnational, you know, in a Christian sense, the idea of Jack, who is a real boy entering into the land of the lost. And there's much emphasis laid on this having never been done before, you know, what does it? It's quite incarnational. If you think of it like a pointer to the way at Christmas, God in Christ enters into the human world, despite, you know, its tendency towards sin and the fact that this is a world of death, you know, but he enters it in order to save. And it is, in the end, it's a profession of being human and loving the things as broken as they are, you know, in the loser's lair, that gives them hope and magically unlocks their prison cages. It's like Really, and then in that sense, Jack saves all the things, not just the one he came to save, you know, which is it's just like, wow, okay, somebody's a Christ figure here, you know, which
Yeah.
again is very consistent with her writing in Harry Potter.
But you know who I also loved? Like, I love the heroism of the small and the marginalized. I think that's like my that's a trigger for me. I just love it. And of course,
Blue Bunny.
that's why I love Dobby so much in the Harry Potter books.
Oh.
And you're absolutely, you knew exactly where I was going. Blue Bunny in this. Blue Bunny, what a hero. What an
Yeah.
amazing character. This Blue Bunny that was a and come on. And we all know this. The really cheap stuffed animal
Yeah.
raffle prize
Yeah.
that everybody gets that's not well sewn and you know
Right.
not well loved and gets thrown out the window into the garden, you know, to be
Right.
buried and forgotten. And then Blue Bunny makes this amazing heroic sacrifice and is, you know, suddenly in the regular world discovered and like beamed up in a golden beam of light by a little girl who wants him and gives him life again. Like, oh my God, I was just, that was when I texted you, it's making me cry. That was the scene. It was Blue Bunny. And Blue Bunny is just such a sweet and like, I'm doing this. I'm doing this. And I just, it was just beautiful. And I was reminded of Dobby all over again.
Yeah, the Dobby of the story, definitely Blue Bunny. Yeah.
You know, I also think that the notion that endings are also beginnings. This is a good New Year's topic.
Definitely.
You know, endings are beginnings. And this novel also shows us that principle that I think is in the Harry Potter, but honestly, I think it's in Cormoran Strike. I think it's in the Ichabod. I don't know about Fantastic Beasts. I'm still thinking about
Well,
Fantastic.
it's still unfolding,
That's
right?
right. We don't know the whole thing yet. But I definitely think that you can see that the kind of circular nature of that is reappearing in The Christmas Pig.
Right, like recycling plays a big role
Yes.
in the eucatastrophic ending of the story, which is really
Yes.
great. As
I
an
know.
environmentalist, I was glad about that, although, you know, I don't know.
Thought it was
I
a little
mean,
cheesy, I'm going to be honest, but I think it fits to perfectly, really.
right. I wish recycling really were the solution to our environmental problems, but I don't think it is.
Yeah,
But
I know. I
yeah.
know. You know, I think the wizarding world is not the setting for this book. So it's not the same Harry Potter universe as I think should be obvious from our conversation now.
Right.
But there is magic in this book,
Oh, yeah.
obviously. So, Emily, tell us, what is the nature and source of magic in The Christmas Pig?
Well, in one sense, it's a portal fantasy, you know, not unlike Narnia, because the characters, they have to get lost to reach the land of the lost. You can't be in the land of the lost unless you're lost. The part that part is very C.S. Lewis, because they don't have total control over the portal and when it's open to them, you know. So kind of like the wardrobe, you know. Sometimes you're in the wardrobe and nothing happens, you know, but you got to be in the right wardrobe at the right time, you know. But it's like Harry Potter as well, in that magic isn't totally contained in the Land of the Lost, just like magic in Potter exists outside of purely wizarding spaces. The things, capital T, things in The Christmas Pig, they can feel all the time, but they seem to be able to talk only in the Land of the Lost and on Christmas Eve, no explanation needed, right? Just because Christmas Eve is just magical, right? So this, I mean, then this is very Oxford school children's fantasy, you know, in the vein of Lewis and Tolkien and Susan Cooper, et cetera, because on Christmas, the mundane world becomes a world tinged with magic, even if temporarily. So Christmas sort of creates this heightened magical space within an already magical story, just like in those other works of children's fantasy literature. So that's kind of what I noticed about the magic in the story. It's it is a magical world, but it's even more heightened because of Christmas.
And you know, I was thinking about, did you read the Raggedy Ann and Andy books as a child?
I don't know if I did.
Oh, Raggedy Ann and Andy had this premise that when the kids were not around, all the toys came to life.
Oh, that's cool.
And I think you know,
like Toy Story.
Yes. When I was a kid, I actually thought that might be possible, you know, world of like, I don't know how all this works. And as a kid, like maybe that is right. And you try to catch your toys when they're, you know, when they're up and moving, you know, I'm showing you like how weird I was as a kid, maybe, but no, I'm not sure I literally believed it, but yes, it was a kind of, it was something I thought like there might be a window in which something like that could happen. And I think it is a kind of logical thing for kids to imagine, especially since they give their things such a life, you know, that you imagine that your stuffed animal has a life and a personality, and you're playing with them doing things like Hobbes and in Calvin and Hobbes. And so, you know, I think that that's a kind of logical thing. And so there's this, you know, idea that stuffed animals, other inanimate objects, you know, might be coming to life. It's this question about where is life and can life exist in objects that you love? That's the alivening that the book talks about. Right. That love can aliven objects coming from human feelings. And to me, that relates some to spell casting or charms or something.
Sure.
You know, this idea that you have an intention and a feeling toward a thing, an object, and it can imbue it with certain qualities. And there's magic in that. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah. And the ending of the book, you know, the Christmas pig gets the last words. It's such a sweet ending because they're snuggled up to go to sleep after their great adventure. And Jack wishes him Merry Christmas and then falls asleep. And then the Christmas pig, you know, even though Christmas is over by now and, you know, the things shouldn't be able to talk, Christmas pig wishes Jack a Merry Christmas as well. And it talks about his little tears, you know, falling from his, because he's so happy, you know, it's so sweet. It's so sweet. But it gives you this little, it's almost like a last minute exception to the rule that they can only talk on Christmas. It's like his experience and Jack's love of him has sort of alivened him enough that he can even talk on other times too.
And I was going to say, and my tears as well, Emily.
I know.
It's another. I was like, oh, maybe cry again.
I think we're tired, Katie. I think beautiful. We're tired.
It was so beautiful. I loved it.
I'm kidding. Yes.
Beautiful
and
sweet.
It is.
I think if you've ever loved a thing, and you know, maybe it was a thing that had a particular significance because somebody gave it to you who was special, that you kind of understand something about that. I thought it was there was a kind of simple childlike profundity to it.
Yes.
That was very moving.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Especially, this is especially touching, I think, if for people who've had kids and seen, you know, the kind of attachments that they form to their things and their toys. And my son lost a beloved Lego clone trooper. Not the Lego clone trooper. He had put it in his pocket and he went sledding, which, you know, I was not consulted about this. So, and he comes back from sledding and this particular clone trooper was his favorite, which is why it was in his pocket. And, you know, the misery over the next few days until I did laundry and we found him in the laundry.
You catastrophe.
They went back to the hill to look through the snow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. He was in the laundry. He was in the laundry the whole time. So his name is now lost and found.
I love that. And I can imagine that in the world of the Christmas pig where, you know, he got rediscovered.
Right. Right.
And then
right.
was lifted up out of the land of the lost.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I know. So he's even more special now. That's the thing. He's even more special because he survived that experience.
Did that happen at Christmas time?
It was last year. I think it was after Christmas. So it was like probably January, February. We got a big snow dump and this initiated the sequence of events. You know, snow is also magical in stories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. And so now you have to share with us what you thought about the magic of Christmas being, again, a kind of source of the magic in this book and how that connects with the themes of Christmas at Hogwarts. And I know you've got a whole big,
paper
on this. So give us the nutshell.
I'm not going to go too far into it, but yes, it's very consistent. And Christmas, because Christmas has salvific associations in this story, as in Potter, And as in Christian theology, you know, Christian incarnational theology, over and over in the book, we hear that Christmas is a night for miracles and lost causes, right? And this is like, I keep saying no explanation needed, but that's just, it's just understood in the story that Christmas has this extra magic to it.
There are sort of ideas about animals being able to speak on Christmas, like at midnight.
Those are some folk notions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what else I noticed? Denise Roper has written a book about I think it's about Deathly Hallows, or it's just about Christian theology and Harry Potter. But she talks about the Deathly Hallows Christmas episode, and she points to the English tradition of the Devil's Knell, K-N-E-L-L, in which churches would toll their bells as Christmas Day arrives, a practice that sprang up around the folk belief that the devil dies each year at the moment when Christ is born. So we have, and of course, you know, Harry Potter readers will think back to that moment in Deathly Hallows in which Harry and Hermione, you know, twist in the air as they're jumping out this window to escape Voldemort at Mathilda Bagshot's home. And Voldemort just misses them. And as that's happening, the church bells nearby are ringing in Christmas Day. So that was a really neat catch by Denise Roper. But we have in this story on page 261, we even get the chimes of a distant clock heralding Christmas Day. And of course, that's the end of the crisis of the plot when all the things get sucked up from the loser's lair and get recycled or whatever's happening with them. And then Jack and the Christmas pig get unlost because Santa is able to nudge the broken angel out of her lost spot. So she becomes unlost, and then she pulls Jack and the Christmas pig with. So it's this moment where the chimes are ringing in Christmas Day and the loser is defeated. And so it's this really interesting kind of echo of this tradition of the Devil's Knell, which, you know, you see also in Deathly Hallows.
That's wonderful. I knew you were going to bring it, Emily, on that one.
Well, I got Christmas covered over here. I've been thinking, I can't get out of Christmas. Although it was really nice that, how often do you get to write an academic project about Christmas, like during the lead up to Christmas? That was really fun.
Yeah.
I have to say that was really fun. I was worried I was going to have to do it in like July or something. And it's just not going to be new. You always hear musicians talking about recording their Christmas albums in July and they're like, this is horrible, you know? And so, then, you know what, I started having a little fun with the names in The Christmas Pig because I was like, oh my gosh, Holly, you know, so Holly is the stepsister. And I didn't even think her name is Holly McCauley, which is a cute little, you know, cute little internal rhyme or whatever. And, but Holly has all these wonderful Christmas associations. And of course it plays such a big role in Harry Potter because of Harry's Holly wand.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of cool too. So then I started going through all the other names.
Okay.
All right. So then, I was like, Brendan. Brendan is the stepdad. Brendan is Holly's dad. So I don't know. St. Brendan is the patron of boatmen and travelers. And you do get some boating in this story. You do, obviously, you know, Jack and the Christmas Pig have a big traveling event, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of travel, actually, in the land of
Lost. Yeah, there is.
They cover a lot of ground. Yeah. Judy is Jack's mom. Of course, that's a form of Jude. So that's the patron saint of hopeless causes. So
perfect.
Works well with Christmas being the night for lost causes. Toby the dog, short form of Tobias, which means God is good. Interesting choice.
Yeah, because Toby's not that good.
He's kind of a mess. Toby's kind of a mess as dogs go.
He destroys the toilet paper roll angel.
Toilet, I know. And he takes down the tree a couple times, including he bites the face of Broken Angel.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, she's part of the reason that they get saved in the end. So maybe maybe God is good.
Well, he's maybe he's like, God is good. He's like playing a role like fate.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that. Yeah.
Right. Or yeah, it's this idea that. Yes, that providence, that God sort of holds us all in the palm of God's hand. So Jack, of course, is a form of John. This seems to indicate sort of like an everyman figure, you know, he's all of us. And I do have to just report my realization that the Christmas pig, you know, like, I mean, I think this is a very Christian story, Katie, because like in the early church, in the early days of Christianity, you know, Christians were kind of known for their love of, you know, the Romans, I should say, were known for their love of pork because, you know, it is not a kosher animal.
No.
It is not an animal that an Orthodox Jew would want to even touch or have any association with. So I thought, I was like, oh, but of course it has to be a Christmas pig. It can't be a Christmas bear or a Christmas dog. It has to be a Christmas pig.
But, you know, I also wonder about that, right? The idea of the uncleanness and this kind of purification and redemption.
Yeah.
But interestingly, it's done in a way that I sort of think about Beth Sutton Ramspeck's work on dirt, you know?
Yeah. And, yeah, definitely.
The idea that you have this object that the degree to which it's been well-loved is reflected in its dirtiness.
Yeah.
And when Christmas pig becomes, you know, an adequate replacement, Christmas pig has also gotten stinky and gray and, you know, it is,
it's like smoke and the canal.
Right. And that, so it's a similar kind of, you know, the making of the thing that, but it's a kind of inversion, right? Because the clean Christmas pig was unwanted, but as he gets experience and dirty and all of that, then he actually is kind of purified so that he becomes again this love object for Jack.
Right.
I don't have that totally worked out, but something interesting going on there.
I think it is interesting, and I think you're right. I think it's very consistent with what we see in Harry Potter in terms of, like, you know, the irony of sort of the dirty or the characters who are less concerned about cleanliness being the more morally upstanding characters, right, in the story.
Now, I have to ask you, and, you know, the name doesn't have particular significance. I mean, it's a name we all know. The famous friend, Santa. What part does Santa play in this magical Christmas story? It's a little bit different part for Santa, I think. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, it kind of is. He plays a really important role in the eucatastrophic ending, which, you know, in Tolkien terms is the good catastrophe at the end that causes the sort of unlooked for joy of, you know, not only did the ring get destroyed, but also, you know, the giant eagles came and took Sam and Frodo back to, you know, out of danger. Right. So they can survive as well.
The idea is, like, you can't really see how this could possibly turn out well. And you get this miracle that actually does have everything working out.
Right. Everything gets tied up with a bow.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. So Santa is sort of the orchestrator of that. But you tell me, what am I forgetting about here? What else is he doing?
Well, I just found it really interesting that Santa is on the Isle of the Beloved, where the lost things go that are lost and sometimes permanently lost, and they can't be found again. And
I found it really the North Pole?
Well, I found it really interesting. You know, there's this little moment where he's like, Santa, what are you doing here? Like, how did Santa get lost on the Isle of the Beloved?
Yeah.
And that Santa is also in the land of the lost in the sense that he's maybe not believed in. He's been lost. You know, and not in the sense that Jack has lost him, but somebody has lost Santa.
Yeah.
And so Santa's on the beach.
Oh, poor Santa. Poor Santa.
But, you know, there's this little moment where it's like, Santa, why are you on the island? Why are you in the land of the lost? And Santa's like, it's like, tell you when you're older, kid.
Gosh. Yeah. I might've even missed that in my desperate plot reading.
Yeah, I just wondered if you thought Santa was maybe a godlike figure or somebody else. I mean, in the kind of Christmas story, but maybe take a little more thought.
That would definitely be very Oxford school, you know. I mean, if you think about in Narnia when Father Christmas shows up and he's got gifts for the Pevensey children, but they're gifts that are tools in their fight against evil. And so it's sort of a somber moment, you know, even though it's full of Christmas joy. You know, he's also got food for him, which, you know, they appreciate, but
just a thought, just a thought,
A good thought.
Yeah. So, I wondered also if, you thought that this book, maybe does it meet Tolkien's definition of a fairy story? We've talked a lot about the eucatastrophe, which is one of his criteria for, you know, Tolkien has this famous essay on fairy stories, where he talks about how fairy stories are maybe the most important kind of literature and not to be looked down upon by adults, because fairy right. stories are where the most profound wisdom happens. And it's, and he has a really Christian read on that mm-hmm. as well, I would say. Mm-hmm. And he has this definition of a fairy story that precludes animal fables.
Yes.
He doesn't like talking animals at all, but I don't know that the Christmas pig is a talking animal.
No. And I think that Tolkien in On Fairy Stories, which is his very, you know, famous essay about this, I think he would see this as a fairy story. I think it's, you know, fairies themselves aside, you know, it's a story about entering into a perilous realm of magic.
Right.
And there, you know, Tolkien says, that's a place where you can encounter both, and this is a quote from that essay, beauty that is an enchantment, an ever-present peril, both joy and sorrow as sharp as swords. Mm-hmm. So it's not this happy-go-lucky Candyland sort of place.
Right.
It's that sense of danger that really has to be present, but it's a spiritual adventure. It's a brush with the numinous. That's what fairy stories mm-hmm. are for Tolkien. That's what fairy, you know, it was capital F fairy, and it is this perilous land. And, you know, the other thing I think would go into his calculation that this is a fairy story, if I can speak for him for a moment, is that it's a good and evil story. And uh-huh. and this also meets his, you know, his criteria. It's a story where the magic is taken seriously.
Yes.
I was really glad that when Jack awakes under the tree, that it hasn't just been a dream. And the pig smells like a canal. And Holly believes him because right. she's not an adult yet. The adults don't believe him. You know, it's very convenient for them to just say this was a dream.
And he knows she doesn't want to do gymnastics anymore, even though she yeah. hasn't told him. And that, yeah, there are these, because I also was thinking that too. I was like, Tolkien doesn't like dreams because I guess he didn't like Alice in Wonderland.
No, he did not. He did not. Yeah. Like, he singles that one out.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really joking about that. Yes. Yeah, he doesn't yeah. like that whole, it was all a dream, which I agree. It's sort of it's a fake out. That's not, right. not cool. It's not right. cool. Yeah. Tolkien would say.
Yeah.
And I think also, although it gives you the, you know, you can have the cover story that it was a dream. You get the, I think it's real. And yeah. like you said, there are these cues that there was real change and real information exchanged in that
right,
ordeal.
Yes, exactly. It was very much a spiritual ordeal. And then, you know, he's mm-hmm. got his sort of four marks of the way fairy stories function.
Yes.
Fantasy, recovery, escape, and consolation. And I think it ticks all the boxes. You know, it's this secondary world. You know, there's a kind of a clear secondary world going on there. For recovery, you know, it recovers in us a vision that's been lost in some way. You know, we might look at our own things,
yeah.
you know, differently, especially those we've lost or found or mistreated or taken for granted, you know, in a new light after reading the story, perhaps with a new kind of appreciation. And that definitely rings true with what Tolkien sees in fairy stories. You know, he also he talks about escape, you know, not in the terms of being escapist. You know, some people like to be dismissive of speculative genre, you know, to say it's just escapism, you know. But he says, why wouldn't we want to escape this mundane world? Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, the world of consumerism,
right.
which is so often associated with secular Christmas, to reflect on the world of enchantment that lies behind it, you know. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien would say that's the spiritual realm, that's fairy, that's the numinous, you know. And then, of course, we've already talked about the way the story consoles us, you know, in that unlooked for joy of the eucatastrophic ending, the happy ending that we didn't even dare to expect, you know, that surprises us out of our complacency and gives us a new hope for the future.
And of course, hope is an actual character in yeah. the book. And because it's not only things that can be lost, but feelings can be lost as well. And so one of the feelings is happiness. And then you also have ambition. But hope is a thing with wings, right?
You have a right.
Emily Dickinson reference there. And
right.
Hope has these qualities that apparently are not just like powers that she herself has. She can't be locked out of anywhere. So the idea is that there's always a hope you can't actually lock hope out.
Right.
Which I think is a powerful idea. But even when she's no longer there, Jack is able to use that idea of hope being able to cut through locks.
Right.
As his right. way that he releases all of the things from the loser's lair.
Right. He frees them through hope.
Yeah.
Which is very incarnational, very Christmas, you know.
Yes.
That idea that it's not, this is not the salvation, the overall salvation, you know, but this is the beginning. This is the hope that points mm-hmm. to the salvation that is to come, you know, which is mm-hmm. very Christmas, very incarnational. Katie, what about you? Do you think the Christmas pig helps us understand anything else about Rowling's work? I know you've done work about thing theory, and I wonder, especially with all of the things, capital T things in this story, I wondered if you had any reflections on how this dovetails with her other work.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think this is, again, it's a kind of powerful confrontation of the material and the spiritual and thinking about how they relate and trying to get beyond a modernist understanding that reduces everything to the material.
Yeah.
And thing theory is this way of thinking about objects that suggests that objects can, once they don't serve just their kind of most obvious function, an object becomes a thing. If you think about the way you use the word thing, right? It's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's something kind of indefinable.
Mm-hmm.
And these objects that have been given human emotion, these inanimate things imbued with significance, consciousness, even agency, you know, they're mm-hmm. making choices mm-hmm. that, you know, they then become something else, something that's not just an object and is maybe more of a thing that it even can be a subject. Mm-hmm. And I think about this in the world of Potter, like, you know, you've got the mirror who tells Harry he's fighting a losing battle when he combs down his hair. You've got the portraits and the Marauder's mm-hmm. map, both of which seem to almost contain pieces of the consciousness of the people who either have created them or who have who they represent. And right. so I think Rowling has an appreciation for the beingness of inanimate objects. And I think the idea is that they get that sense that their ontology, their being, from their proximity to the human. And there is this other thing called object-oriented ontology. Ooh.
Unpack that for us.
The three O's.
Or just for me.
and the object-oriented ontology is more that objects have a kind of right to being that is not, that doesn't depend on their like usefulness or their proximity to the human. And you see in environmentalism, you know, sometimes people are talking about, you know, the rocks have a right to exist, just exploding them for our own purposes and so on. And I don't really think that's J.K. Rowling's idea. I believe that she thinks that it's when objects are in proximity to the human and when they are given that significance, consciousness, that value by their association with the human, that they become, you know, a kind of extension of the human world. Now, that said, I think that she often shows things being treated in ways that are not humanistic, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's one of the critiques that we see of the Potter works, you know, that, you know, you've got these objects and, you know, they have a kind of consciousness, but then do they not care about them? You know, and I think about this as one of my problems with the Christmas pig also, like, oh my gosh, are we supposed to care about all these things?
I know.
You know, how do you throw away the kid's toy that's beyond saving, you know? And I guess she has the whole idea of replacement and so on. And the idea that things never really go away because you've loved them, even if they don't exist materially anymore, they still have an existence. But you know, I think
unless the loser eats them.
Yes. And I think also think about all those poor objects who are in the disposable land.
Right.
They're just
right.
disposable. I feel for the comb.
I know.
You know?
I know.
And
the poor comb.
Oh, it's very hard. But I think that this book is a kind of extension of her notion of the way things and human beings interact and the mutual significance that they create among each other. That is a kind of magic, but it's a kind of everyday magic in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, she's a kind of, she's exploring how objects become precious to us.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting idea. The other thing that relates to some of my research, and I won't say too much about this, but, you know, I'm interested in maps and space in Potterverse. And I've just really taken by the fact that the organization of this whole novel is a journey through a land that you could map it.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a map in the book. I don't think it has a map unless I missed it.
Nope. I didn't see one.
But the chapters take you through the various places. You know, you go to Mislaid, which is sort of your hub where you're sorted. Yeah. And then there's Disposable and Bother It's Gone.
Bother It's Gone. I like that one. That's most of my stuff. Right. Everything's Bother It's Gone for me. I'm
And then you've got The Wastes of the Unlamented. Talk about that. That's the peril part of the perilous realm.
Yeah.
And it just has such a geographic realness to it as a place that I just thought there is a journey. There is a, you could draw a map, you could actually take them through this land. And, you know, there's a, I think, really important idea about the power of travel and experience of travel for, again, transformation.
Oh yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Definitely. Blue Bunny.
Oh, Blue Bunny.
So I lament you. I lament you, Blue Bunny.
So I don't know about you, Emily, but I hope that Rowling will continue to do this kind of writing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like the Cormoran Strike novels. I feel that her misanthropy is very much on display there. You know, her sort of difficulty with people and the flawed nature of humanity. Yeah. But in these works that she has written for children, and I would put the Ichabod in this category too.
Same. Yeah.
I think there is real value. And I think that these are important books for not only kids to read, but I want to keep reading them myself.
Right. Yeah. There's like a hopeful filter over them, especially when you compare them to what goes on in the Strike novels, which, I mean, obviously are supposed to be a totally different thing, but still, I prefer to exist in these worlds made for children, made with children sort of at the center of them, and children's stories and children's hopes and fears and dreams and beliefs. It's a wonderful place.
And they're not saccharine.
No.
But they have that element of delightfulness, you know, and she has a real talent, I think, for this particular kind of storytelling. And so I hope she'll keep doing it.
Yeah, me too.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Emily, so nice to have a chat just between the two of us about The Christmas Pig.
I liked it. I liked it.
Yeah, I learned a lot from you, as always.
Yeah, same.
We're going to end today with a quote from The Christmas Pig, of course, and particularly from the original pig, Der Pig, who said, "Losing is part of living, but some of us live even though we're lost. That's what love does." In this new year, a time of both endings and beginnings, we at Potterversity wish you consolation, the reclaiming and remembrance of that which has been lost, the power of hope and love, and a peaceful 2022.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.